On today's episode of There Is a Floodlight That Never Goes Out, we chat to broadcaster and football finance expert Kieran Maguire. I chat to him personally about the transfer embargoes for 10 championship clubs and how easy it will be for these to be lifted. I also talk to him about Glazernomics and Manchester United and how they will be sold.
I speak to Kieran about the scrapping of salary caps for League 1 and 2 and his personal opinion on parachute payments.
And I speak to Kieran about all things Sheffield Wednesday, what relegation means financially and the legality of issues such as deed taxes. I also have a little chat with him about Birmingham City and the recent selling of the stadium.
Strap yourselves in. I think this is the best podcast we've done yet. Hello and welcome back to another episode of the There's a Floodlight That Never Goes Out podcast. Today, as always, I'm joined by Ed and Will, and I'm delighted to say we are joined by Kieran Maguire. How are you, Kieran?
I'm sound as a pound, boys. It's never a dull day in football, is it?
No, it isn't. And I think today of all days, I can't believe our luck that we've managed to get you on a day where news as big as this has come out. I mean, our first question is about it. News has come out today that Sheffield Wednesday, Birmingham City, Blackburn Rovers, Coventry City, Cardiff City, Derby County, Huddersfield, Luton, Reading and Stoke, I think I'm going to have to catch my breath there, have been placed under a transfer embargo. Firstly, why is that?
Well, the EFL doesn't appear to have given any details. So we're trying to sort of dig in a bit further. This is a story that was broken in the Mail, and it would appear it's for some form of breach of financial fair play. Now, the clubs have come out fighting. The clubs are really hacked off with regards to this, I think, getting into getting aware of it. So Luton and Coventry, to my knowledge, have said it's purely to do with admin. And the background of it, without wanting to sound too nerdy, and stop me if I do, is
right,
that under UK company law, you normally have 9 months in which to produce your account. So most clubs have got 30th of June year end, so therefore they have to produce their accounts by the 31st of March the following year and have them audited. And that's fine under normal circumstances. Some people are aware of there's this thing called COVID-19, which has a slight impact upon the economy, upon the way that people are able to interact, and also upon sort of day-to-day business activities. So the boy Rishi, Mr. Sunak to you and I, he said, well, because companies are struggling, he was going to change the law and give companies, including football clubs, an extra 3 months to publish their accounts. So therefore, instead of having to publish them for the 31st of March 2021, you've now got until the 30th of June. So some clubs said, thanks very much, Rishi, we'll do that. And the EFL said, well, we're going to ignore that rule, and we still want you to have your accounts in and audited by the 31st of March. It looks like a dozen clubs haven't managed to do that because they seem to think that the law of the land is more important than the EFL. And that's why they've been given this sanction. So it does seem, on the face of it, very, very strange indeed.
Yeah. So to follow that up, how easily will it be for these clubs to have these embargoes lifted?
Well, it should be relatively straightforward. Remember, it does seem to be a bit of a technical issue in the sense that there's no transfer windows open at present. And therefore, they're not missing out on much, with the possible exception of it could be that technically you're not able to sign a player who's out of contract or something of that nature at present. But if they do send in their accounts over the course of the next 3 months, then on the face of it, unless the EFL finds something wrong with the account in terms of exceeding FFP limits, then you would expect the clubs to be allowed back in. Otherwise, it will be absolutely farcical if we reach this summer with half of the clubs in the Championship being not allowed to recruit new players. It will make next year's Championship a bit ludicrous.
Yeah. So, you know, clubs, some clubs who have been implicated in this have already had embargoes in the past, you know, come to mind Sheffield Wednesday and Birmingham City. Will this, you know, sort of put another mark on their record with the EFL, and could it affect them in future, or will it literally just be, you know, brush it under the carpet? This was something that we didn't recognise.
It shouldn't. I mean, you know, the EFL, to give them some credit, are big enough and bold enough to know that, you know, things will happen. It's just like a player getting a yellow card. You know, you get a yellow card, and as long as you don't do it again too quickly, then there's no need to get a red. I think with so many clubs implicated, if the EFL decides to take a more aggressive stance against clubs, then I think the EFL needs to remember that EFL decisions are ultimately decided by clubs, in terms of having votes. So it could. What we don't want is a situation as we presently see in the National League, where there's civil war taking place. So having seen the comments from the likes of Coventry and Luton, who seem very peeved, to put it mildly, that this has got out, and also the fact that they've got these embargoes, I think the EFL would tread very carefully and just let things follow their natural course, i.e. the clubs put out the accounts, and then if our understanding is correct, and there's an awful lot that we don't know what's going on, because the EFL is not a very transparent organisation, then the clubs automatically should return to being allowed to transfer players.
Good stuff. I think Will's got something to ask you now on the salary caps.
So surrounding, obviously, salary caps, salary caps at the moment are in place in League One and League Two in the Football League. And am I right in saying that they were in the Premier League, however, they actually voted to remove them when in a weird stage where they actually seemed to start working, and then they were voted to be removed?
Yes. So the Premier League, it was a strange type of wage cap, in the sense that you weren't allowed to increase your wage bill by more than £7 million a year, plus any money you made on from the plus profits from the transfer market, plus any extra money the club itself generated. So effectively, you disregarded the broadcast income. And there was no doubt that it was slowly starting to take hold, because, you know, I was seeing comments from individual managers who were moaning about it. And I think Sam Allardyce was one, which is unusual for Sam. He doesn't moan very often. But then all of a sudden, they just said, oh, we're abolishing that rule because it's starting to be effective, which did seem a bit daft. And the squad salary caps in League One and Two were very quickly kicked into touch, because they were imposed by one side of what's an effectively a collective bargaining agreement between football clubs and the players, without consulting the players themselves. So the premier sports lawyer in the country, in my opinion, a guy called Nick DiMarco, he acted on behalf of the Professional Footballers Association, and that very quickly overturned the position of the EFL at the time.
Yeah. So obviously at the moment there is no real salary cap in the Championship, and do you think it'll stay that way, or do you think we'll ever see a salary cap introduced into the Championship?
Well, in order for a salary cap to operate within the Championship, we need to have two things occur. First of all, we need 16 club owners to vote in favour of it. Yep. Now, they could have voted for it last August, but they couldn't agree. And the thing is, if you are in a room with two Championship club owners, you will get at least three opinions on something. You know, there's the idea that club owners are all operating with the same viewpoint is incorrect. I'm sure you've seen historically some of the rather testy comments. Mel Morris doesn't get on particularly well with the people at Leeds. He doesn't get on particularly well Steve at Steve Gibson at Middlesbrough, and so on. So there's a lot of big egos in the Championship owners' club, it's a real challenge for Rick Parry and the others to try to get them in, keep them in check, and try to get them all lined up in the same direction. So it's a real tough job that they've got in the EFL, and I think that they wanted ideally to have some form of wage cap, but the owners said, no, we're more interested in getting promoted, so forget that.
Yeah, okay. And then obviously slightly different salary caps, there's the whole idea around parachute payments. And I know in the past you've referred to them as like a necessary evil, which is, you know, they don't look great on the face of it, but if you've been realistic, they're definitely a thing that we need to have. So what is your kind of opinion surrounding parachute payments?
Well, parachute payments are a clumsy solution to the big problem that we have, which is the gaps between clubs and divisions. So we have effectively, we've got the Premier League, which is operating at two speeds, with two or three speeds perhaps, where we all know who the big clubs are, or I refer to them as the G6, the greedy six, and they on average earn £350 million a year, more than the other clubs. And then we drop into the Championship. The average wage bill in the Premier League for a non-Big Six club is probably around about £110 million. Yeah. Now, if you drop into the Championship, the average wage bill will be around about 20. So if you get relegated, you're dropping into a division where wages are potentially 70 to 80% lower. Are you going to be able to recruit players? Let's take the January transfer window. You're 18th in the Premier League. You want to sign a striker for £20 million. The average wage for a player in the bottom half of the Premier League is probably around about 40 to 45 grand a week. So you say to him, here's a 3.5 year contract. I'll pay you 45 grand a week. And the player says, and he's a good looking player, coming from France or Italy or Slovenia. It doesn't matter where it is, but it's a good offer. And then you say, by the way, we're 18th in the Premier League, and if we do get relegated, we're going to give you an 80% pay cut. Now, under those circumstances, would you move your family from wherever it is at present, come to England for 4 months, and then take an 80% pay cut?
Well, no.
No. So can you see the problem? As a consequence of that, the clubs, and remember, the parachute payments is voted on by the Premier League. The clubs in the Premier League says, we don't want to crash. I mean, what is the purpose of a parachute? It's when you jump out of an aeroplane, it stops you from crashing on the rocks below. Yeah. So the aim of the parachute payments is to slow the descent of your revenue. You're going from a TV deal, which is worth £100 million a year, to a TV deal in the Championship, which is worth £7 million. So the aim of the parachute payments is to say, well, instead of going from 100 to £7 million immediately, we're going to do it in a over a period of years. Now, if the gap between the Premier League and the Championship was much narrower, we wouldn't need parachute payments.
Yeah.
But in order for that to happen, we need the Premier League to make a decision. And remember, the Premier League was formed in 1992 because clubs didn't want an equal share of money between the big clubs and the less big clubs. And that's why we have this rather strange situation that we've got three bodies running English football, whereas in Germany, you've got Bundesliga 1 and Bundesliga 2. In Italy, you've got Serie A and Serie B. In Spain, you've got La Liga and La Liga Segundo and things of this nature. But England has set itself apart. And the Premier League, to a certain extent, is a victim of its own success. It has been so remarkably popular that it's got more and more and more money over the years at a far faster rate of increase than what we have seen in the EFL. And no disrespect to the clubs involved, but realistically, who's going to tune in to watch Reading versus Middlesbrough?
Yeah.
Apart from the fans of Reading versus Middlesbrough. Mm-hmm. And in the Premier League, you know, there are probably 8 or 9 clubs who can get really big audiences. So that's where we are at present. In an ideal world, I'd get rid of parachute payments. And the way I'd get rid of parachute payments would be creating a football environment where there's no need for parachute payments in the first place. And there's a far more equitable distribution of revenue between all clubs.
Is that something we see more like in the NFL, for example, where there's kind of any money left over is equally spread between, you know, other clubs or teams?
That's right. I mean, you're absolutely right. If we take a look at the NFL, the way that it operates is that the match day revenues are 60% goes to the home club and 40% goes into a pool. All merchandising income is pooled. All TV income is pooled. And of course, you've then got the draft system, which means that the clubs finishing bottom have access to the best talent the following year. And this prevents dynasties. You know, we've seen what's happened in Scotland. Nobody apart from Rangers and Celtic has won the Premiership since 1985. So, you know, if you are Aberdeen, what's the point? And you've got to ask yourself that question. Then you look at Bayern Munich, and you know they've won the Bundesliga for the last 7 years. We've got similar with Juve in Serie A, and things of this nature. And that's not healthy for football domestically, to have clubs winning the competitions year in, year out. So the advantage that the NBA, NFL and NHL have and so on is that they don't want a competition which is like that, because it's bad for TV audiences.
Yep. All right, thanks very much.
Kieran, you mentioned earlier the work of Nick DeMarco, the man responsible for halving my team, Sheffield Wednesday's points deduction to 6. Unfortunately, despite that, perhaps I'm jumping the gun a little here after the 5-0 demolition of Cardiff City, but relegation looks unfortunately just around the corner. Financially, how devastating could that be for the Owls?
It will be significant. I mean, I mentioned that the clubs in the Championship get around about £7 million a year in TV money. In League One, it's about £1.5 million. Now, there are parachute payments between the Championship and League One, so that will help Sheffield Wednesday to an extent. And provided they can shift the high earners off the wage bill this summer, then it shouldn't be too bad for the club. But it will still be challenging. It's not as easy coming straight back up out of that division as Sheffield Wednesday fans might think, because you've only got to look at what's happened to Sunderland. Yeah, they're in their third season. Ipswich are there, Portsmouth are there. Yeah, there are some big clubs in that division. And if Sheffield Wednesday did drop into League One, they would also be a scalp. So, you know, there's plenty of teams that play good quality football in that division, and they will raise their game, because, you know, coming to Hillsborough and playing in front of 20,000-25,000 people is a feather in their cap if you're a player, and clearly the fans are up for it as well.
Definitely. Thank you very much.
So, you know, we've talked about the salary cap maybe coming in the Championship, however hard that may be. But do you envisage a shift in financial play post-pandemic, with clubs becoming much more sensible and maybe, you know, adopting a Barnsley or Brentford-esque system when it comes to their operating finances?
Unfortunately not. Football has a track record of very short memories and very stupid decisions. So I appreciate you're far too young to remember this, but I can recall when ITV Digital went bust.
Oh, and that was... I remembered that because it's part a key part of Barnsley history. That's why we went into administration.
Ah, yeah. Right.
ITV Digital.
Yeah, so ITV Digital was a fantastic TV deal, but it was nuts, because it was based on giving out lots of money to the clubs, and again, I don't want to insult you, Barnsley versus Millwall Wednesday night. How many viewers is that going to bring in to the TV yeah. channel? So the money was going out, it wasn't coming in, and then ITV Digital went bust. How much did clubs learn from that? Well, absolutely nothing. Then in 2007, we had the global economic crash caused by, if you've seen The Big Short and things of that nature as a film, it's one of the greatest films of all time, as far as I'm concerned. It was caused by financial shenanigans, is the politest way of describing it. And that hit the global economy. How much did football learn from that? Absolutely nothing. We've had the introduction of financial fair play. So have the club said, right, we've had to introduce these rules. It's about time we got our house in order. What are we seeing the clubs doing? Well, they're selling stadiums to themselves. They're getting sponsored by, as somebody will be able to confirm on this, by taxi companies that own no taxis. we've got unusual payments from unusual people. It's all fairly crazy because everybody's saying, yes, well, I agree with the rules in principle, but they don't apply to me. It's a bit like, you may be aware, I'm a Brighton fan. I live close to the South Coast. If I'm out walking my dog down the beach, there's lots of people on the beach. I'm thinking, well, aren't we supposed to be socially distancing? And the common reply is, well, yeah, I agree with the principle of social distancing. I just think it should be done by somebody else. And it's exactly the same when it comes to financial fair play. Yes, we agree with it in principle. We think the other 23 clubs in the Championship should do it, and we should be able to allow to do whatever we want.
Yeah.
Kieran, you just mentioned there, I think you're alluding to D-taxis.
The legendary D-taxis, indeed, yes.
Top quality service, may I just say. I often look and I think, how is that legal? Could you maybe shed any sort of light onto that?
It's legal because you've got to ask yourself, first of all, what laws have been broken. So there's been no UK company law broken because D-taxis has been set up as a company. It's then up to the EFL to determine whether or not a fair value has been given to the sponsorship arrangements. And the vibes that I'm hearing, and this is all sort of hearsay, and you sort of talk to people in the game and take notes and so on, is that they're not very impressed by it, but actually the amount involved isn't big enough to warrant a separate charge. So they'll turn a blind eye to it because they thought that they were going to absolutely hammer Sheffield Wednesday with regards to the stadium issues. I heard at the time that the other clubs, and you're probably aware of this, they were gunning for a 21-point deduction in 2019-20, and Sheffield Wednesday have ended up with a 6-point deduction in 2020-21. And that is down significantly, but not exclusively, to my good friend Nick DeMarco. And if there's not a statue of him outside Hillsborough, there should be.
Definitely.
You mentioned about the club's gunning there for the 21-point deduction, and you talked about the split at boardroom level in the EFL. But could you maybe talk about Paul Conway, the owner of Barnsley, and Matthew Bentham, the owner of Brentford, and how unique their systems of running a football club are?
Certainly I know quite a lot about Matthew because he took the view that there are there's a lot of untapped talent in the game. There are far too many kids who are being rejected at the ages of 16, 17, 18. So the strategy that they employed at Brentford Football Club was to scrap their academy. So rather than identify kids at the ages of 7, 8, 9 and try to bring them through, and remember, Brentford are in London. So therefore, if they did manage to recruit a good, very young player, the chances are that that player would be poached by a bigger club at a little bit of an older age. So they'd ended up with very little. So therefore, they sort of twisted the argument around and said, well, we're fully aware that at 16, 17, 18, clubs such as Chelsea, Arsenal, Spurs, West Ham, and so on will be releasing players who they don't think are good enough. what we're going to do at Brentford is to offer those players an opportunity to get game time. And instead of going through the sort of traditional under 16, under 18, under 21 route, we're going to have instead a B team, and we're going to play clubs on the continent and develop the players that way. And the other thing that they do is that they use data analysis to identify quality players on the continent and bring them to England to play for Brentford, put them in the shop window with a view to moving them on. So although Brentford lose money, just as all clubs do in the Championship on a day-to-day basis, they manage to normally wipe out those losses because they spotted Ollie Watkins, Neil Mopay, Tarkowski, and players of this nature, and those players move on to the Premier League. So they've effectively positioned themselves as a conveyor belt team, in the sense that they won't stand in a player's way, and in fact they see players as commodities who they can buy cheap and sell high. And if you can do that, absolutely fantastic. It's a very, very smart model to use. And Barnsley, because of their connections with Billy Beane and the Moneyball model, is broadly similar.
Yeah.
Something slightly different, Kieran. Birmingham City's owners announced a deal to sell their remaining 75% stake in the stadium. I think I saw an article saying that you said it wasn't anything to worry about. Could you maybe just explain why that's the case?
I think saying it's nothing to worry about is perhaps a bit strong. At the same time, it's not necessarily a nightmare. I'm never comfortable when a club does split its stadium away and sells the stadium to another party. As a Brighton fan, we did that, and it took us 14 years to get back. We've seen the issues experienced by Coventry City and things of this nature. So there is a concern. The reason why I'm a little bit more relaxed with regards to Birmingham City is the ground has now been sold to a person who owns a company in the British Virgin Islands. Now, normally that is a normally that's a bit of a jeepers creepers. What's going on here?
Yeah.
So I just stopped there because it started hammering down with snow outside my front window, and I'm on the south coast. It's not supposed to be like this in April.
I was going to say snow in the south, unheard of.
exactly. And also, of course, that does mean the whole of the south will grind to a halt because they can't cope with it.
I'm sure BBC News are already getting their headlines ready.
If it's happening in London, it's news. If it's happening elsewhere, it's schmooze.
Absolutely.
That's the BBC for you. So in terms of Birmingham, it's not great, but it's not necessarily a disaster. And the reason for this is that there is something called an ACV, which stands for an asset of community value order, over St Andrews or the Trillion Trophy Stadium, as fans prefer to refer to it, of course. and on the back of that, it makes it more difficult for an owner of a football club to sell the stadium or to knock down the stadium and convert it into retail units or industrial units or other types of property. Now, harder isn't the same as impossible.
Okay.
So Birmingham do have a 12-year lease, so it does give them some breathing space. Provided they keep paying the rent, then there shouldn't be an issue. At the same time, given that the owners are based in Hong Kong and the new controlling party of the stadium is based in Hong Kong, as we saw with Wigan Athletic, a decision could be made by a couple of people sharing a meal together to say, would you like to stop paying the rent? And the other party says, yeah, okay, we'll stop paying the rent. And then the landlord can legitimately say, oh, they've stopped paying the rent, which means that we can evict you and start to try to convert. So it's not a perfect situation.
Yeah.
At the same time, what I don't want to do is to be guilty of scaremongering myself. I didn't feel great about it, but the reaction on social media is, oh my God, yeah, we've got nowhere to play. And also, because Birmingham and Villa aren't the best of pals, you don't necessarily want to give ammunition to Villa to go ahead. So I think you've got to try to tread a middle line. Yeah, you know, I'm. Am I allowed to swear on this?
Yeah, do you want?
Okay. I enjoy a bit of shithousery. Yeah, I enjoy getting out a big wooden spoon and stirring at times. But if it winds up club owners, that's one thing. What I don't want to do is to unnecessarily get fans worried. So, yeah, with regards to the news which came out this morning in relation to the Mail story, the first thing I did was put it out myself. And then try to get to the bottom of it. And it does appear that it is more of an administrative and technical issue than necessarily clubs going bust. I think the Mail headlines of financial Armageddon were perhaps a little bit OTT.
Well, very unlike them.
Yeah, completely out of character. Completely out of character. And I read that. I mean, I read the article three times and no mention of Harry and Meghan. I was, in fact, slightly disappointed in the Mail.
Well,
that's the same Daily Mail we all know.
Yes, exactly. No, and love, of course.
I'd probably shift in a completely different direction to anything we've spoke about so far. But I'm really interested in Glazernomics, as it's coined, at Manchester United. One question that really interests me is, can Manchester United feasibly ever be sold?
Oh, yeah. Easily be sold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I've read multiple articles say, you know, due to the Glazers' grip on things, it would be very difficult for Manchester United to be sold. So do you think it's completely opposite to that?
No. It would take probably 4 out of the 6 Glazer children to agree to sell the club, and then it would be achieved, because between them they own 70. Yeah, we've got 6 of them that own 75% of the shares. Mm. So yeah, 4 out of that 6 is probably just over 50%. And once you've got more than 50%, you can then install the board of directors that you choose. You could offer to buy some of the remaining shares from the stock market and so on. So it's not difficult at all. I think that the view of the Glazers is that Manchester United is undervalued. And if they get their way, and their way is smaller Premier League, bigger European competitions, more overseas tours, they own their own TV rights, then Manchester United is hugely undervalued, and they could certainly make a lot more money from it. And certainly that's their aim. Let's be brutal here. They've got no interest in football as a sport. They've got no interest in Manchester United fans as football fans. And yes, it's easy to laugh at some of the fans at Old Trafford. And I used to play for Trafford Cricket Club and share a dressing room with proper United fans, you know, who are exactly the same as all other fans. United have a large number of selfie stick, jabbing, Cantona 7 shirt wearing idiots. But then all the glamorous clubs have trophy supporting fans rather than proper football fans, and you just ignore them. But I think for true Manchester United fans, they've had a really tough 15 years, because you know, should they carry on supporting the club that they love, or you know, we have seen a number of them move across and set up FC United of Manchester, which is a fantastic community-based club, which I think has got all of the ethics that you associated with the old Manchester United rather than the Glazer Manchester United.
Yeah. And secondly, on Glazernomics, due to the massive debt that's actually attached to the club, is there any way possible for United to spend the money that's talked about every day pretty much in the national press, you know, £100 million on a Erling Haaland or Jadon Sancho type player?
Oh yeah, nothing to stop them at all, because they people are prepared to lend to Manchester United to allow them to buy the players, and there's nothing wrong with debt. Yeah, it's servicing debt, and what Manchester United have done is that they've pushed back the repayment dates for the loans. So the loans are, and I use this word in inverted commas, the loans are only costing Manchester United around about 20 to 25 million pounds a year in interest. Now, when the club is generating between 5 to 600 million a year, the interest on the loans actually isn't a significant amount. They've got the biggest wage bill in the Premier League during a significant proportion of the time that the Glazers have been in charge. It has got tougher for them, but the only reason why it's got tougher for them is because there's new kids on the block in the form of Chelsea and Manchester City and the wealth of their owners. And we've seen the resurgence of Liverpool or you know, a few seasons, and you know, never discount them as well.
Yeah, that's great. Just to finish then, I think this is something that a lot of people will be interested to hear. UEFA are set to get rid of FFP or financial fair play regulations to give teams greater control over their finances. What will be the positives and negatives of this?
The positives is that in theory, it will allow for clubs with ambitious owners to compete with the established European elite. So if the rules are relaxed, the present rules prevent another Manchester City or Chelsea or PSG challenging for European competitions. So if the rules are changed, then if somebody comes in and buys Newcastle United and says, I want to put in a load of money into the club, I want them to break into the top four, provided that money is presumably not in the form of loans, I think that will be the issue that will be one of the key elements of the replacement. FFP is not going away. FFP is going to be changed. I think that's what we need to remember. How it's going to be changed is as yet unknown. But if it moves to more of a, you can spend as much money as you want, provided that money comes in the form of equity from the owners, and perhaps they also have to guarantee for the first 2 years that they, if they sell the club, that they underwrite the losses or things of that nature, then we could see you know, the greedy six become the greedy 10. You know, we could, right, yeah. Because the Mashiri at Everton, Wes Edens at Villa, PIF and Newcastle, I fully anticipate West Ham being sold, Newcastle being sold in the next couple of years. They could have new owners come in. You know, West Ham is potentially very attractive because it's in London and it's got a huge stadium. But you know, the existing owners, and I'm not going to criticise them here for this particular, you know, they have a limited amount of money that they can afford to put into the club. Whereas if it's a sovereign wealth fund, then the sky's the limit.
Good stuff. Well, I think I speak on behalf of all of us here in saying I think that might just be our most interesting episode ever.
100%.
Dropped brilliant. A lot of knowledge bombs.
Thanks, guys. Well, I just like the name of your podcast as a huge fan of the Smiths, before Morrissey became a complete arse. I once met Johnny Marr at a party, which is still about as good as life gets, really. So, yeah, well, congratulations and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Thanks you very so much.
Okay.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please give the video a like, or if you're listening on Spotify, please subscribe to the channel. I think that was a brilliant episode. Cheers.